And now on WRS, Michael McKay with the McKay Interview.
Hello, everyone. I was born on a small island, as were my parents and grandparents, for that matter, Jamaica. And then, because of emigration, I grew up on a larger island, Great Britain. And now I've lived in landlocked Switzerland for more years than I've ever lived on islands. So I think my perspective is quite balanced. But islands, depending on their size, location, and proximity to much bigger landmasses, have a special place in history. There's little doubt, at least in my experience, that geography heavily influences national culture and outlook. Perhaps you're of the same view. We're going to take a trip to one particular island today off the northwest coast of continental Europe. In fact, I am, diplomatically speaking, actually on the territory of the Emerald Isle. I'm inside the Irish Permanent Mission to the United Nations, Geneva, and the guest today of Ireland's permanent representative, Ambassador Michael Gaffey. Good afternoon, Your Excellency. Thank you for inviting me and our listeners to the McKay Interview here at the Permanent Mission.
You're very welcome, Michael.
It's good to see you again, Mike. It's good to see you. For the benefit of our listeners meeting you for the first time, you've been in this job since August 2017, and before that you were the Director General of the Development Corporation Division, Irish Aid, at headquarters in Dublin. You gained your wide international experience dealing with the Western Balkans and Southeast Europe, as well as being posted to places as far afield as Tokyo, London, Cairo, Amman in Jordan, Baghdad, Belfast, and Chicago. It's quite a mix and quite a selection. There are many nations or groups usually, but not always small, with large diasporas around the world. One thinks of Poland, the Philippines, Britain, Iran, Lebanon, the Jews, not forgetting the Swiss, the Italians, the Spanish, the Greeks, and even the Chinese. All had quite different reasons for leaving their places of origin and homes. Ireland has a very large diaspora of people who claim ancestral links. I think you once told me, Ambassador, that you mentioned the number to me, but I've forgotten the number, but maybe you can mention how many people claim links when we have our conversation. For example, President Biden is not the first US president, nor will he be the last, to stress his familial ties to Ireland. So, Ambassador Michael, if I may, I'd like to learn more from you about Ireland's unique history and destiny. But let's start with your day job, so to speak. Where does the multilateral dossier on your desk fit into the bigger Irish picture? What does Ireland bring to the UN here in Geneva and the UN in New York? And Ireland is currently a non-permanent member of the Security Council. Why is that important to Ireland? And how do you use that membership to good effect? There's a flurry of questions just to get the ball rolling.
Well, thank you very much. There's a lot in that. Ireland is a small island. We're just 7 million people, Northern Ireland and the Republic. And yet, for reasons of history, which we can go into, we would estimate there are about 70 million people of
70
Irish
million
descent
good
in the world.
Wow.
10 times the population of the total island. Mm. So you can imagine, as a small, open trading economy, that engagement with the world is vital for our survival. We traded our way out of the financial crisis, which hit Ireland very hard in 2008-09. And it was because we were an open trading economy that we were able to recover with difficulty, but relatively quickly. So we see engagement with the world as a vital element of our foreign and domestic politics. Initially, when we got our independence 100 years ago, it was seen as a way of asserting our independence. Now I think we see it more as engagement with the world as global citizens. We are dependent on each other. So our work here in Geneva and in New York is central to that. In Geneva, our focus is very much on human rights, on disarmament, on humanitarian crises, and we try to link them together and not to work in silos, as it were. And we work very closely with our colleagues in New York for the 2 years that Ireland is on the Security Council. And that we've been on the Security Council since the 1st of January this year. It's for a 2-year term. We're an elected member. We fought a very hard election. There were 3 candidates for 2 seats, Ireland, Norway and Canada. It was a daunting prospect to go into that election. But we won, and we've been working very hard on some of the biggest crises in the world. We ran on a sort of a slogan highlighting our approach as one of empathy, partnership and independence. We have a different background to many other European countries for reasons that we can go into. And we've been bringing that approach to the Council this year, for instance, on issues like the humanitarian crisis in Tigray, cross-border humanitarian aid for the Syrian crisis. And what we do in New York and here very much is focus not just on the views of governments, but also on the views of affected populations. So here in Geneva, one of our big priorities we're known for in the Human Rights Council is civil society space. In other words, working to ensure that communities and community organisations in crisis areas around the world and elsewhere have a say and have a voice in our deliberations.
Can I stop you there, Michael? Could you just give a practical example of what that means? How do you do that? For people listening who may be not familiar with the way the United Nations works, how do you do it?
Well, actually, in Geneva, it is actually possible for civil society to engage in the debates in the Human Rights Council. We engage with them both here and in countries around the world on the issues that we're raising here.
So you go to the countries,
we have a network of 80 to 90 missions around the world.
Who carry
the message, consult with civil society and bring the message back. And we've been doing that in New York too, where on the Security Council, it's states that speak. But we engage with community groups, with women's groups, to bring that voice to the table. And that was a pledge that we made when we were running for the council.
And it's laudable that you're involved in disarmament, but are you a non-aligned state, or is that an old-fashioned phrase that no one uses?
Well, we're not a member of NATO.
We're not a member of NATO. I see.
Okay. But we have been very much involved in disarmament, going right back in the 1960s when the Non-Proliferation Treaty was negotiated. The origins of that were a number of resolutions that were known as the Irish resolutions in the UN. We had a very strong position on disarmament. And here in Geneva, as we speak this year, we are taking the lead on the negotiation of a political declaration on the use of explosive weapons in populated areas to try and make a difference in how explosive weapons are used. And it's got very wide participation, very strong engagement by the full range of states, and we hope to finish that later in the year.
And just two more questions. I mean, are the people of Ireland engaged in the fact that their country is on the Security Council? I mean, does it mean a lot to Irish people in Ireland, or are they probably just oblivious to what's going on?
No, I think it means a lot. It means a lot. The election was a source of huge pride. But the engagement by our own civil society, by our own groups, is quite intense. And they put quite a lot of pressure on the government to take positions on certain issues. No, Irish people are very politically minded. So there is
a lot of vigorous discussion.
And we raised expectations that we have to meet.
Yeah, good. That's excellent. That's excellent. And of course, the population generally is highly literate and well educated, so that helps engage a more informed debate.
Yeah, but I mean, I know even going back to when I was growing up, Irish people were always interested in problems around the world, and sometimes even in taking sides on those, just in debates at home. So I think it's normal for Irish people. Irish people have relatives everywhere around the world. If there are 70 million people of Irish descent, that means that every Irish family has people somewhere, and sometimes in the strangest of places. So I think there is no crisis in the world where you're not going to find Irish people living.
Well, my own name shows some connection with Ireland. There are McKays in Ireland.
And it's not even just when there's a crisis. If you go anywhere in the world, I guarantee you're going to meet an Irish person.
That's true. In my experience, yeah. Michael, is Ireland in good shape for the global rough and tumble of the years ahead? I mean, you've been through rough and tumbles before, so you know what it's like out there. But your national history is full of great tragedy, battles with a much larger neighbour, large-scale emigration, which robbed your country of vital and energetic talent, and economic ups and downs, as you mentioned just before. They daunt the best of us will be daunted by that. But also great poets and writers. I think of Emilia Yates and, of course, Joyce, who actually lived in Switzerland, in Zurich. during the First World War. So many who have given the English-speaking world much pleasure and much to reflect on. But candidly, what does Ireland, in your view, still need in order to be on a sure footing for a sound future? Or is Ireland all ready for it?
Well, is anybody ever ready, I suppose? The COVID outbreak showed us that we have a lot to learn about managing risk. Just to pick up one point you mentioned, Joyce is actually buried in Zurich.
Is he so really buried? I didn't realise that. I've been to his pub.
Yeah. No, his grave is in Zurich.
I didn't know that.
Now, many Irish people would say he should be brought back home, but it is in Zurich.
Okay.
No, is Ireland ready? Look, I think we're engaged, we're living in a very uncertain world. And Ireland's history in 100 years of independence has had its ups and downs. We've had moments of being very introverted and insular. We really opened up to the world in the 60s. A huge element in our building of prosperity and opening more to the world was joining the European Economic Community in January 1973 with the UK and Denmark, I think. And we've had our ups and downs, and that's why. And we've had a lot of emigration during the difficult economic times, but I think we've learnt a lot from these ups and downs. We've learnt how to manage our economy and manage our affairs better. We certainly learnt a huge amount from the huge financial collapse in 2008, which hit Ireland very, very hard. And so I think there's a greater understanding now of the need for sustainable policies, sustainable economic policies, and frankly, policies that are sustainable in terms of climate change too. So we have a much stronger recognition of that now. And the Irish people went through very difficult times only a decade ago, and they are determined that we won't do so again. But there are always shocks. I mean, we've had a number of shocks in recent years, and we'll come to them again. We've had Brexit, we've had COVID. But, you know, we're starting, hopefully, to come out of the COVID pandemic. Hopefully the rest of the world, we can come out of it as a world together sooner rather than later. And we have a lot of lessons to learn from that in terms of a sustainable future.
And is it correct that young people have started to come back to Ireland, or am I misinformed?
Yeah, no. Actually, in the last boom in the noughties, a lot of Irish people returned. A lot of Irish people returned. In the big financial crisis, there was emigration, but not on the huge scale before, because many places were closed because they too were suffering the financial crisis. A lot of young people went to Australia, for instance. And everyone wants to return, and there are people returning. So we would hope that will be the case.
My guest today is Ambassador Michael Gaffey, Permanent Representative of the Irish Republic to the United Nations and other international organizations, Geneva. And we're talking about Ireland's place in the world and in the multilateral order. Michael, in this centennial year of partition, how does the modern-day Irish Republic view the UK, and in particular Northern Ireland, and can demographics and goodwill be the solution to eventual unity? Please explain how you see history in the future.
Well, that's a good question. How do I see history in the future? We are living through, in Ireland at the moment, a decade of centenaries. The centenaries of the period 1916 to 1923, which were the turbulent years which led to Irish independence. And as you rightly say, this year is the 100th anniversary of partition. And there is a strong focus on debating partition. I think in the old days, people had very simple notions in a way. In the North, Unionists said under no circumstances would they have dealings with the Republic. And in the Republic, many people said, let's get rid of the border and all will be well. The really kind of seminal moment, the vital moment for Ireland came following years of violence, but also of peace efforts and negotiations with the Good Friday Agreement in 1998. And that gives us the context, I think, for the relationships on our island. And that agreement was negotiated in recognition of the different set of interlocking relationships between the people of Northern Ireland and the people of Great Britain, between the people of Northern Ireland and the people of the Republic, and then between the two islands. And the institutions that were put in place take account of those three interlocking relationships. Nothing is easy. We're still working on it 22, 23 years later. But there has been, I think, a fundamental change in the sense that the agreement recognise the validity, and this is the Irish and British governments as co-guarantors, plus the communities. They recognised the validity of the two identities in Northern Ireland, British and Irish. And they recognised that people had the right to claim British identity or Irish identity or both. And that has been vital in helping free up a space for dialogue and discourse. But of course, it's not easy. And a peace agreement is not an end in itself. There's a process that has to continue after that for a long time.
I don't mean to simplify or devalue what you just said, but just give us a glimpse of what these institutions actually are. Just give us a sense of these institutions you talk about that were created as a result of the...
Yeah, it's like in Northern Ireland, you've got an executive, a power-sharing executive, where power is shared between the representatives of the two communities. It recognises that there are two communities. I mean, at some point in the future, people may vote in a different way, but a lot of people vote in accordance with their community identity, although not exclusively. There's a growing number who don't. There is also a North-South Council, which deals with cooperation on practical issues.
Non-political,
between North,
essentially.
Well, there are political representatives on it, but they're looking at practical cooperation across all areas, from tourism to waterways to practical
and
cooperation.
They talk regularly.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And then there is British-Irish Council as well for discussion. And look, it looks like a lot of institutions, but there's a lot of problems that need to be... of interlinked problems that need to be discussed, and you've got everybody represented there. Also vital, though, is the involvement of community groups and communities. And one of the important elements that helped negotiate the Good Friday Agreement was the presence of the Women's Coalition, a coalition of women from both sides of the community who pushed, got themselves elected, were involved in the negotiations, and they were really responsible for many of the human rights clauses that are in the Good Friday Agreement.
And you've not mentioned the Americans, although an American was the one who was sitting actually in the sort of neutral moderator facilitator seat. Are they out of it completely now?
No, I didn't mention the Americans because they're not part of that immediate triangle. But the American administration, successive administrations, consistently have been hugely supportive of the British and Irish governments in negotiating a solution to Northern Ireland. And George Mitchell, Senator George Mitchell, was the chair of the talks.
I had the privilege of meeting him once.
And he was vital and inspirational. And he has his own background helped him in the sense he has a Lebanese background as well. Mm. So the American administration has been hugely supportive, continues to be so. Also, the European Union has been hugely supportive, both in terms of political support and financial support for the settlement.
You mentioned already, Michael, the European Union. My question on that is the EU an effective stage on which Ireland has played and will continue to play its part? If you could give me some examples of how the EU has been of great benefit to Ireland.
Membership of the EU has been vital for the modernisation of Ireland, I could say.
Infrastructure or
everything. Infrastructure, absolutely. I mean, the motorways that are built across Ireland were funded.
I've driven
in large
them,
part
yes, that's,
by
okay.
the European Union. Yeah. The modernisation of agriculture, in terms also the opening up of Ireland to the rest of the world, and in terms of the peace process. So I would say that any opinion poll taken now would show about 90% support for EU membership. So it's a central part, I think, of our identity now.
I see.
And it has helped us place our own national issues in a broader context. And we see the EU, as the EU sees itself, as not just an economic project, but a peace project also. And that has been a vital benefit to Ireland.
I see. Now, I was curious because it's clear that the EU has played an effective part with Ireland's recent history, but I wasn't really sure to what extent. I mean, for example, has Irish business as a place of business benefited, for example, since Brexit? I mean, have companies moved in or expanded their business in Dublin or other major centres in Ireland Or is that, again, too simplistic an analysis?
Well, I think the outworkings of Brexit are still a work in progress, shall we say. But membership of the European Union helped Ireland hugely in terms of attracting direct foreign investment, because you had a country with an increasingly well-educated population, English-speaking, seen by many companies as an entry or a base for entry into the European Union.
A springboard.
So that has that has been in the 70s, 80s, 90s, that has been vital. Brexit itself is different. There's a lot of difficulties there and a lot of issues that are being worked on. We don't really look at too many positives for Brexit, but we certainly look at resolving the issues.
Okay. I mentioned at the beginning of the Irish diaspora. Just want to go into it a little bit more detail. Is it really that important to Ireland? Why is it so important to Ireland? If it is, maybe you'll challenge me on that, given that 70 million people somehow are linked themselves to Ireland. And is it influence simply nostalgic and yearning by many across the sea? Or is there more to it than that?
Well, you know, it's funny with emigration. Initially, when people leave a country because of poverty, unemployment and famine, indeed in Ireland in the 19th century, those who leave often don't want to think back about the country. They want to make a new life and not to think about it. Those who stay often feel almost inferior in their minds to those who've left and they think become rich. So there's a settling period, actually, as the country develops. And we're now, we're at a stage now where we have a much clearer relationship with the diaspora. We had a major campaign to attract them home to Ireland for holidays and visits back to their places.
Oh, you did that.
In 2013, it was one of the things after the depths of recession we went through.
Okay.
And so we called on the diaspora to come home and discover your roots. It's a family thing. Every family has people. Every family has relatives, not just in the States, in Canada, in Australia, and all around the world. So it's an emotional link. But it's also real in terms of tourism, in terms of education, and just in terms of exchange. And the United States, I have to say, has been particularly helpful on the peace process and in terms of economic development. But also at a human community level, there's a lot of exchange between Irish people of Irish descent and their home areas. And sometimes they discover it late in life, sometimes they discover it early in life.
Mrs. Biden, Reagan, Kennedy—they all did the similar things.
Well, yeah. Well, they all of them came from families who had emigrated. But you'll find now that there's a lot of young Americans who come to Ireland to find where their ancestors came from, and then to go to university in Ireland, or Irish people might go to university in the States. So I think it's a very healthy relationship now.
Michael, my last question is a bit long, so forgive me. But in a previous conversation, I told you of the significant influence that Irish Catholic priests and nuns and Irish lay teachers, too, had on me personally in my formative years of primary school education growing up in the west of England in the 1950s and 60s. It was all good. The social changes over the past 20 years in Ireland have been dramatic. The fall from grace of the Catholic Church and its dominant position in and over Irish society must, I imagine, be one of the main reasons. The former President Mary Robinson was on my show about 4 years ago and talked with great insight about the societal changes. She herself played a leading part in some of them. What is the mood, in your estimation, on social issues in Ireland today? What are the differences, if you can articulate them, between the way in which the over 60s look at Irish life compared with their children who might be in their 40s and their grandchildren who may be teenagers or in their early 20s? And in your day, your day-to-day life as ambassador of your country, what do people ask you here in Geneva about Ireland, and what do you take great pleasure in highlighting?
Well, you know, the image of Ireland for the first years of independence, the first decades of independence, I think the image out there of Ireland was that it was a conservative, introverted country. And you know, it's true. In the 1920s, Joyce was banned in Ireland. Joyce wrote a lot about his relationship with Ireland, which wasn't in his mind at all a happy one. And yet all his books related back to his time in Ireland. So I think nowadays the image of Ireland is of a progressive young country. Now, why has that happened? Ireland has opened up. I do think that joining the European Union was a very important moment, because
what year was that again?
1973. But immediately there were certain social legislation that had to be brought in to bring us into line with the rest of the EEC.
Mary Robinson told me as well.
And so equal pay for men and women, and those sort of vital moves were taken because we joined the European Union. Just to go back to my own work very briefly, it was also because we joined the European Union that we started a development aid programme, which is now very strong. But the changes that have happened in Ireland, I would say, have been driven by the Irish people, and they've won strong support. If we need to make a major change to anything that exists in the Constitution, we have to have a referendum. We had a referendum that allowed divorce, because that was banned.
So constitutionally, you must do that.
Yeah. Well, it depends, because divorce was included in the Constitution as not being allowed. But most recently, for instance, I suppose I would say that we had a referendum in 2015 on marriage equality. We were the first country in the world to have a referendum on marriage equality. And that was driven by young people. It wasn't driven by the political parties. It was driven by young people, and the young people campaigned, and they campaigned on the basis of stories of their own lives. They told it to their families, and their families told those stories then to other people. And there was a very strong endorsement, which might not have been predicted, and outside Ireland would not have been expected. There was a very strong endorsement for marriage equality. When you look back to the controversies we had in Ireland in the 1970s and 80s on the legalisation of contraception, it's quite a move that the Irish people voted overwhelmingly in 2015 for marriage equality.
Yeah.
And that's now just taken as the norm in Ireland. So I think Irish people are much more comfortable with themselves and comfortable with themselves in the world. And I don't think that it has involved any fight against the Catholic Church. It's just that people have moved ahead.
Mm.
So I think here we still are dealing with the legacies of old problems. There are issues about mother and baby homes, and they come up here in Geneva. They are a matter of concern in terms of human rights.
They're mentioned here, are they?
And that is good, because it shines a light on issues that we need to deal with.
And we have been
helped by that human rights focus on issues in Ireland. Every country has issues to deal with, but if you brush them under the carpet, they're harder to deal with, and they will come back. And these are really, really difficult issues. Other countries have them too. But I think they're seen now in the context of where Ireland is today. That couldn't possibly happen anymore. In Ireland, we still have huge controversies on these issues, and there still will be campaigns to say we're not dealing sufficiently quickly or sufficiently sympathetically with the issues. So they are still very live issues in Ireland. But we're doing so in a world where we can speak openly about the problems. And frankly, in the past, we didn't.
That's a good and optimistic and positive point to end our conversation. Michael, thanks so much for inviting me to the permanent mission and for answering all my questions so frankly and fully. My guest today has been Ambassador Michael Gaffrey, the Irish Republic's permanent representative to the United Nations and other international organizations in Geneva. Thank you, Michael.
Thank you very much. Thanks.
That was the McKay Interview with Michael McKay. And don't forget, you can hear that interview again on our website, worldradio.ch.